KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
I believe the system is safe. There are multiple redundancies throughout the system that keep people safe.
After crises at Newark and other airports, what will it take to fix air traffic control?
It is Wednesday, May 21st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, many of Israel's European allies are criticizing the country's latest moves in Gaza.
But U.S. Ambassador Mike Huckabee continues to support Israel's conduct of the war.
I'm outraged that the U.K., Canada, France, they're blaming the wrong perpetrator.
Also, how a few simple tweaks to brick making could improve air quality in Bangladesh.
Because of the process, a lot of that coal won't even get to the bottom, and so they use quite a bit more than is necessary, which is why they're so heavily polluting.
And at the Cheers pub in Boston, people remember the man who played Norm.
That's ahead. Fresh news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa was in the Oval Office today, where President Trump accused South Africa without evidence of allowing a genocide of white farmers. NPR's Moore Lyson has more.
Trump played a video for Ramaphosa that he said proved his point. But Ramaphosa pushed back, saying that the majority of crime victims in South Africa are black, not white. And he brought up some white friends who would vouch for him.
I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me.
In addition, Ramaphosa also brought some friends of Trump, South African golfer Ernie Els and billionaire Johan Rupert. Ramaphosa said his country does have a crime problem, and he asked Trump to help solve it by making a deal, selling South Africa drones and other security equipment. Mara Lyason, NPR News.
The Trump administration announced it will end investigations into six law enforcement agencies, including the Oklahoma City Police Department. Grayson Wheeler with member station KOSU has more on what that means for the department and for residents.
The Justice Department announced its investigation into the Oklahoma City Police Department in 2022. Earlier this year, initial findings found the department violated federal laws in its treatment of people with behavioral health disabilities. Now, the Trump administration is rescinding those findings and shuttering the investigation. Tisharia Moore Dickerson is the executive director of the city's Black Lives Matter chapter, which participated in the investigation.
We're going to have to recenter and focus on removing this violent act against reducing state-sanctioned harm.
An Oklahoma City Police Department spokesperson says the city will continue working to improve its practices. For NPR News, I'm Grayson Wheeler in Oklahoma City.
Retailer Target today unveiled first quarter earnings numbers that showed lower than expected sales. The company also revising down its forecast for the entire year. Target cites some customer boycotts over the company's rollbacks of policies on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Stocks slumped today as bond yields rose. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow fell more than 1%.
Investors are getting jumpy as House lawmakers move closer to passing a tax cut and spending bill that threatens to add trillions of dollars to the federal debt over the next decade. Policymakers' indifference to rising debt levels have already cost the government its AAA bond rating. Bondholders are demanding higher returns, and that means both the government and private borrowers will have to pay higher interest rates. Markets have also been rattled by lackluster retail results, suggesting U.S. consumers are growing cautious about spending money. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Looking at the numbers, the Dow fell more than 800 points today. The Nasdaq dropped 270 points. You're listening to NPR. A large number of Americans are consulting non-traditional spiritual practices. That's according to a new survey. Catherine Post of Religion News Services has more.
According to a new survey from Pew Research Center, 3 in 10 American adults consult a fortune teller, tarot cards, or astrology at least once a year. Those practices are especially popular among younger adults and women. And, the survey finds, nearly half of LGBTQ Americans consult astrology at least once a year. Chip Rotolo of Pew says this isn't surprising.
These practices sometimes emphasize things like fluidity and openness.
Still, just 6% of U.S. adults say they rely on these practices when making major life choices, according to Pew. For many, it's just for fun. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Post.
It's a problem an increasing number of zoos are grappling with. What to do with aging elephants who get to be too large for their enclosures. Two elephants, Billy and Tina, were quietly moved from the Los Angeles Zoo to a zoo in Oklahoma, despite lawsuits seeking to have the animals transferred to a sanctuary where they'd have more room to roam. The announcement that 40-year-old Billy and 59-year-old Tina would be sent to the Tulsa Zoo angered animal rights activists who say the elephants should be able to live out their lives in final days outside of a zoo. Crude oil futures prices moved lower amid continued global uncertainties, including talks with Iran about its disputed nuclear program. Oil fell 47 cents a barrel to settle at $61.57 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Federal regulators are limiting the number of flights in and out of Newark Liberty International Airport. The move comes after a harrowing month for travelers at one of the country's busiest airports, and also for the air traffic controllers who work the airspace around it.
We lost our radar and it's not working correctly. Radar service terminated.
Communications and radar systems went dark several times at the air traffic control facility in Philadelphia, where controllers manage the airspace around Newark. As you can hear in these archived audio recordings from the website liveatc.net.
We don't have a radar, so I don't know where you are.
FedEx 1989, I'm going to hand you off here. Our scopes just went black again.
Three of our radar screens went black and they have no frequencies.
Hundreds of flights in and out of Newark have been canceled or delayed. And now, the Federal Aviation Administration is slowing the pace of arrivals and departures. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy insists that that will help.
I believe the system is safe. There are multiple redundancies throughout the system that keep people safe. The key is not efficiency. The key is safety.
Still, these incidents have raised huge questions about how the mess in Newark got as bad as it did and what it will take to fix an aging air traffic control system. Today, we're going to hear a perspective from inside that system, from an air traffic controller who was working the airspace around Newark during one of those outages. NPR's Joel Rose covers transportation and joins us now. So, Joel, who was this air traffic controller that you spoke with, and what can you tell us about them?
What I can say, first of all, is that they work in the Philadelphia TRACON. That's short for the Terminal Radar Approach Control. These are facilities that handle traffic in highly congested airspace, in this case, around Newark. This controller asked us not to use their name because they are not authorized to speak publicly by their bosses at the FAA, and they're afraid of retaliation for speaking out. They also asked us not to use their voice for the same reason. So what you're going to hear in this story are their words, but they will be read by one of our producers.
Got it. Okay. And as we just said, this person was on duty during one of these outages. What was that like?
They said it was incredibly frustrating to have the tools that they rely on to do the job simply fail, losing contact with fully loaded jets traveling hundreds of miles an hour in some of the nation's busiest airspace. Again, this is the voice of an NPR producer reading the words of the air traffic controller.
It was like disbelief, and then it was just like fury, honestly. Like, how could they have us working this, you know? Frustration, anger, like just being furious at the FAA, because we had other outages prior to that point that demonstrated to us that our equipment was unreliable.
This controller says the FAA is paying a lot of attention to their concerns now, but that was not always the case before. The controller says they had asked the FAA to slow the number of planes using this airspace, but were told no.
Wait, go back a little bit. How did things in Newark airspace get so bad?
I know, this is the big question that a lot of people have. In a sense, Newark is suffering from the same problems as the entire air traffic control system in the U.S. There's underinvestment in technology and systems that are, in many cases, decades old. And there's a shortage of staffing for air traffic controllers. The system nationwide is thousands of controllers short. All of that is true, but according to this controller, the things that happened in Newark are also very specific to Newark. And in particular, the way the FAA moved the air traffic controllers who work the Newark airspace from Long Island, New York, to Philadelphia last year.
So this particular situation was a self-inflicted FAA decision to move us out of New York. We did not have these issues when we were in New York. And so you're trying to make it seem like, well, the FAA is in shambles and that's why Newark is this problem. No, Newark is the problem because you moved us out of New York without a real plan.
Let me back up here for a moment. For years, the FAA had been talking about moving control of the Newark airspace out of Long Island, which handles the other two big airports in the New York area, LaGuardia and JFK. And for a long time, the FAA had trouble hiring enough controllers to staff the facility on Long Island. The training success rate there was also low, and those who did work there made a lot of money in overtime. So the FAA decided the long-term solution here was to move the controllers who handle Newark to Philadelphia, where the cost of living is lower and it would be easier to recruit. Here is Michael Whitaker, the FAA administrator during the Biden administration, explaining the rationale for this back in November.
With this move, we're able to relieve the stress in New York and improve controller staffing levels by recruiting and training controllers in Philadelphia. This has been meant to get us healthy on a staffing level.
As part of this move, some of the controllers from Long Island were forced to relocate. They all get a bonus of $100,000, but many still do not like this because they have families, kids in schools. The controller we spoke to was not happy about the move.
I get it in a sense, like, why? They were like, well, let's move it somewhere else. But I feel like the way they went about it was really haphazard. It was really reckless, honestly. And it was a little bit cruel to us as people, as the controllers who they moved.
There had been 33 certified air traffic controllers working the Newark airspace from Long Island. Two dozen of them made the move last summer to Philadelphia. And according to the controller we spoke to, some of them had big concerns even then about how the move would work from a technical standpoint. Still, the controller says they tried to keep an open mind, but even they were surprised at how badly it has gone.
It's been worse of a disaster than even like the most cynical people in the union predicted. It's been a debacle.
The FAA did not respond directly to these allegations, but the agency says it is working on an expedited plan to install new fiber optic lines to replace the copper wires that are still in use in some places, and adding new backup systems to help with the technical issues in Newark. And Sean Duffy, the transportation secretary, says the agency is, quote, supercharging the hiring of new air traffic controllers. But the reality is that it takes years to train them, and there is a nationwide staffing shortage right now. That is especially acute in Philadelphia, where some of these controllers have taken trauma leave to recover from the psychological impact of the recent outages, including the controller we spoke to.
We are at our limit. Our families are telling us you need a break. Like, our friends are telling us you don't seem okay. We're all at that point. Like, you can tell people are breaking down. You can see the misery when people show up to work. There have been grown men crying in the parking lot on their breaks because of our work conditions.
God, it just seems unsustainable. I guess the bottom line is Newark Airport safe?
A lot of people say yes. The FAA just announced that they are temporarily cutting the number of flights in Newark to 56 per hour. That's a number that reflects what the air traffic control system can actually handle. But I put this question to the controller who works the airspace, and here's what they told me.
I had my best friend ask me the other day, like, I got a Newark flight. Is it going to be fine? I was like, no. Don't fly out of Newark. Like, at the very least, you're going to be delayed, but no. Like, I've had to book flights, and Newark is the cheapest option, the most convenient option, 9 times out of 10, and I'm not going to do it.
Even the transportation secretary, Sean Duffy, admitted that he had his wife change her flight from Newark to LaGuardia Airport in New York City, mm-hmm. not because it was unsafe, he said, but just because she needed to get where she was going. And I think a lot of people will be wrestling with those kinds of choices.
That is NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose. Thank you so much, Joel.
You're welcome.
Last night was a special one at the Cheers Pub in Boston.
Locals and out-of-towners shared memories of the hit show from the 1980s and early 90s and one of its most beloved regulars, Norm. George Wendt played Norm on Cheers and died yesterday at the age of 76. WBUR's Sue Von Lee headed to the pub to talk with the folks who gathered to reminisce and celebrate.
And one APA. Okay.
Inside this cozy, dark wood-paneled bar, people talk and laugh around the tight space. Framed Red Sox and Cheers memorabilia line the walls. Waiters hustle, balancing burgers and fries, while bartenders pour beer from taps. A mix of 80s tunes fills the room. At the end of a bar is a small memorial dedicated to George Wendt. A single bar stool, a vase of flowers, and a photo of the actor wearing Norm's signature suit and tie. And to top it off, a mug of beer.
Norm was one of the best.
Miles Heger says he started watching the show during the pandemic. He drove to the pub from his home south of Boston about a half hour away when he heard Wendt died. It felt as if the character himself was gone.
I said, one place I gotta be tonight, and that's right at Cheers in Boston, so here I am.
John Snyder was expecting a long line to get in. He orders a light beer, just as Norm, the character, would.
I know he was a beer drinker like I am, major beer drinker. But, yeah, it's sad to hear that he died at such a young age.
Frank Irizarry greets guests at the front entrance. The 24-year-old says he had never seen the show when he started working at the bar 2 years ago.
I would see people run in here and say, Norm, where's Norm's seat at? And I didn't know who Norm was at the time, so it was kind of funny to me.
Irizarry is only on episode 7, but now he's hooked on the character.
I totally get like the whole entire like idea behind more, like that dude had a larger than life personality, and just his presence on the TV show, like he made Cheers. Like Ted Danson's going on, Woody Harrelson, but most people come here when they wanted to hear about Norm.
Steph Coronella was a huge fan of Cheers growing up. She says Norm was relatable and funny, someone who enjoyed the company of friends at his daily hangout spot.
Norm was just like an everyman, like you could just identify with him. He was a little henpecked, but super sweet and so sassy.
Fans remember something special happened every time Norm walked into the bar.
Afternoon, everybody.
Norman?
Hey, what's happening, Norm?
Miles Heger says Norm will be missed.
Many bar regulars from many bars all around the country are going to live on because of Norm.
Norm also had a way of making an exit. George Wendt passed away yesterday, exactly 32 years after the Cheers finale. For NPR News, I'm Sue Von Lee in Boston.
All those nights when you've got no lights, the check is in the mail, and your little angel hung the cat up by its tail, and your third fiancé didn't show. Sometimes you wanna go where everybody knows your name.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank. Part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Gaza, hospitals in the north have shut down in the space of 24 hours. That is because Israel has begun a new ground operation in Gaza in which it says it plans to take territory and hold it. In a moment, we will hear from the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, about the latest offensive and how European allies are responding. First, though, NPR's Aya Batraoui reports on how hospitals in Gaza rapidly collapsed in the face of an offensive that has killed hundreds in the past week and displaced tens of thousands more.
A home has just been struck in northern Gaza's Jabalia. It's Tuesday night, and this video by rescue workers shows them digging with their bare hands and a shovel to reach a family buried in the rubble. A young girl in her pajamas is pulled out, lifeless. But a young boy, bleeding, stunned, covered in dust, is among those carried out, alive. Except there's no hospital for him to be rushed to in northern Gaza. The nearest one is several miles away in Gaza City. That's because in the past 24 hours, hospitals in northern Gaza have been targeted by Israeli shelling and bombardment, forcing them out of service. The head of ambulances in northern Gaza, Faris Afana, says the situation is catastrophic with no medical services in the area, reminding him of Israel's lengthy siege late last year that left the north in ruins and damaged its hospitals, which have now collapsed. The Israeli military says it's targeting Hamas infrastructure in Jabalia and has killed a Hamas fighter accused of taking part in the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel. The Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza had dozens of patients until Monday when staff shared this video. It shows fire crews putting out a blaze in the hospital's courtyard Monday night. Health officials say Israeli drones bombed the hospital's generators. Staff and patients fled after the bomb strike because Israeli tanks were advancing. Israel's military hasn't responded to NPR's request for comment on its strikes on hospitals. The attacks on this vital hospital and two smaller ones in northern Gaza this week come as Israel is expanding a new offensive aimed at pushing the population south and forcing Hamas to release hostages. It issued evacuation orders for northern Gaza. Influential Israeli finance minister Bezalel Smotrich told reporters the military is moving civilians out of combat zones. The aim is to move people to southern Gaza, and he says, with God's help, from there to other countries. That, he says, is the goal. Gaza's emergency workers say an estimated 100,000 people are still in the north. But with no hospitals to treat them, it's unclear how much longer they can remain. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza City.
Some of Israel's closest allies are harshly criticizing the country. The leaders of Britain, France, and Canada are calling on Israel to end its latest military offensive in Gaza. The European Union is reconsidering its political and economic ties with Israel. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee says such criticism is misguided.
I'm outraged that the U.K., Canada, France, they're blaming the wrong perpetrator.
The new ambassador sat down today with NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv, and Daniel's with us now. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
Could you tell whether there is any frustration at all from the U.S. over Israel's handling of the war right now?
Ambassador Huckabee told me there is absolutely no rift between President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He said he has spoken to President Trump, to the Vice President, to the Secretary of State, and has not heard about any frustration with Israel.
What I'm hearing is they're frustrated. They want the hostages out, but they're not blaming the Israelis for it. They're not blaming the Prime Minister for it. They're blaming Hamas for it, which we all ought to be doing.
How does Huckabee respond to the criticism from European countries?
Yeah, there has been extraordinary criticism from the leaders of the UK, France, and Canada, as you mentioned. They put out this statement about Israel's newest offensive, which began Sunday. Israel has ordered mass evacuations of civilians in Gaza. It's stepped up airstrikes throughout Gaza and killing, according to health officials there, hundreds of Palestinians, including babies and children. And the leaders of those three European countries said, yes, Israel suffered a heinous attack on October 7th, 2023 from Hamas, but they said Israel's current offensive in Gaza is disproportionate. And so I asked Ambassador Huckabee, does the U.S. support this latest offensive?
I think we recognize the sovereignty of Israel. Israel had people murdered in the most vicious, horrible way that we've seen. And I wanted to say since the Holocaust, but in all candor, as awful as the crimes were in the Holocaust, they weren't worse. And in some cases, they weren't as malicious.
Now, the ambassador went on there to describe Hamas atrocities during the October 7th attack. He repeated some unsubstantiated claims about that attack. And I questioned him again about the criticism from European allies about what Israel is doing now.
But these allies are saying that Israel's response today is disproportionate, is intolerable. You've seen the pictures of dead children every day.
Sure.
Do you agree with that assessment?
No, what I agree with is that Hamas could have stopped this on October the 8th and they didn't. The prolonged suffering for everybody is on Hamas. And I'm outraged that the UK, Canada, France, they're blaming the wrong perpetrator. They need to start putting the pressure on Hamas. Right now, they're willing to give Hamas a victory.
Daniel, as you have reported, Israel did not let any aid into Gaza for more than 2 months, and only now, after intense international pressure, has Netanyahu said that Israel is letting in a, quote, basic quantity of aid. So what did Ambassador Huckabee say about that?
Well, he talked about a plan that the U.S. is backing to get food in, and he criticized the United Nations and aid agencies for not cooperating with that U.S.-backed plan. Now, the United Nations says it's a plan that actually is intended to help Israel force Palestinians into concentrated zones in Gaza. They call it against humanitarian principles.
So broadly speaking, what does Ambassador Huckabee say about U.S. support for Israel's conduct in Gaza right now?
He said Israel is a sovereign nation. It has a right to prosecute the war the way it believes will end the threat posed by Hamas. And the ambassador went back to a comparison to World War II. He said European leaders don't question the Allied bombings on the Nazis, so they should support Israel's campaign now against Hamas.
I just find that so disgustingly hypocritical on the part of some of these European nations that forget their own history, and it wasn't that long ago. And they ought to just go back and maybe take 10th grade civics and refresh themselves.
And so what does it mean, Daniel, for these long allies to now find each other on opposite sides of this conflict, where the U.S. and Israel are more or less isolated, with the rest of the world aligning, saying this is unacceptable?
It really is a new chapter in this war, Ari. This is a significant shift from what we've seen in the past 19 months, these top allies of both the U.S. and Israel coming out in an extraordinary statement calling Israel's actions in Gaza egregious, and furthermore, the European Union taking action against Israel. This is a moment that we haven't seen before in this whole war. And Ambassador Huckabee in Israel did not back down from his support for Israel's actions.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin, who spoke today with U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Madera Arredondo is in his third year as Minneapolis's chief of police, the city's first black chief, when one of his officers killed George Floyd and his city exploded in rage.
No one was saying, yeah, Rondo, here's the playbook. When you're leading in crisis and you have to literally make life or death decisions, I will always lean towards life.
His reflections 5 years later on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The drama around tariffs has slowed down this week.
Yeah, so why is Wall Street still worried?
Just a general perception that the U.S. is perhaps a riskier place to park your cash than it was 6 months ago.
Plus, the government office that told Doge, no thanks.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. An explosive scene unfolded at the White House today as President Trump confronted South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. Trump dimmed the lights in the Oval Office and played a video of anti-white chants from South Africa, accusing its government of enabling violence against white farmers.
I must tell you, Mr. President, we have had a tremendous number of people, especially since they've seen this. Generally, they're white farmers, and they're fleeing South Africa, and it's a, you know, it's a very sad thing to see.
Ramaphosa pushed back, saying the chants do not reflect his government's position.
Have they told you where that is, Mr. President?
No. I'd like to know where that is, because this I've never seen.
Ramaphosa insisted that crime in South Africa affects all citizens and warned that Trump's rhetoric could stoke global tensions. Google is making artificial intelligence a more prominent part of its search engine. It's a step to compete with AI chatbots, which analysts think will snag an increasingly large share of the market. NPR's John Ruich has more.
Google's new feature is called AI Mode, and Chief Executive Officer Sundar Pichai says it's a total reimagining of search. AI Mode appears to operate like other AI chatbots, answering questions, making suggestions, and entertaining follow-up queries. Google has dominated internet search for about a quarter century, but analysts and industry insiders believe that increasingly powerful AI chatbots like ChatGPT and Perplexity pose a threat as more and more people turn to AI for answers. Concerns about AI's incursion into the search arena grew earlier this month when an Apple executive testified in a court case involving Google that traditional Google searches in Apple's Safari browser had fallen for the first time in two decades. John Ruich, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. A federal judge says the White House violated a court order on deportations to third countries. The court ruled the Department of Homeland Security breached its directive by deporting eight men to South Sudan without giving them a chance to contest their removal. Three witnesses testified in the sex trafficking trial and racketeering conspiracy of Sean Combs today. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports a Homeland Security investigations agent testified about a search conducted at one of the hip-hop mogul's properties last year.
DHS agent Gerard Gannon told the court that authorities found drugs, platform heels, and baby oil in Combs's Miami mansion. These are all supplies that were allegedly used for the highly orchestrated sexual encounters that the government is accusing Combs of forcing his ex-girlfriends into. Psychologist Don Hughes later took the stand. She did not evaluate any of the people associated with the trial, but provided expert testimony on why victims stay in abusive relationships. Former executive assistant George Kaplan also began his testimony, describing working 80 to 100 hours a week to make sure Combs had everything he needed. Kaplan will continue testifying on Thursday. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
Stocks closed sharply lower on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 816 points. The Nasdaq fell 270. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification,
whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Wall Street is having a rocky week, another one. The Dow fell almost 2% today while investors are selling off bonds from the U.S. government. Now, those bonds form the backbone of the global financial system. But now investors are so worried that they are making what is known as the Sell America trade. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here in the studio to tell us about it. Hi, Maria.
Hey. Hey there.
Okay, so it's only Wednesday and sounds like it's already been a week on Wall Street.
Another week, another really wild ride on Wall Street. And stocks are down so far, but the real story is that people are selling off bonds. That has sent yields on long-term U.S. government debt to jump above 5% this week, which is really unusual. And it's especially unusual at a time when the stock market has already been so volatile.
Why?
Well, bonds are supposed to be the safe and stable part of the financial system. But now we're seeing all these warnings that everything is not so safe and stable anymore. I mean, just today, the European Central Bank warned that President Trump's tariffs are putting the global financial system at risk. So obviously, tariffs continue to hang over everything. But this week, the main headline has really become the U.S. national deficit, which is running close to $2 trillion.
Although that piece isn't new, right? The deficit has been huge and getting huger for a while now. Why is it an issue suddenly?
Well, it's all come to a head because of two things. First, President Trump and his party are trying to pass a budget bill that would include tax cuts. Tax cuts means less revenue coming in, and that will make it even harder for the government to reduce the deficit. And then on Friday, Moody's downgraded the United States. It specifically cited the rise in the national deficit, and it said that it doesn't expect the Republicans' budget proposals to create what it called material reductions in that $2 trillion. Uh-huh. Mary Louise, this wasn't a shocker. The other big ratings agencies had downgraded the U.S. years ago, but the timing, as the White House and House Republicans are trying to pass this bill, that sounded a lot of alarms. So all of this is leading investors back to what is known as that Sell America trade.
Yeah, so stay there. What is the Sell America trade? It does not sound good.
No, I mean, bluntly, investors are worried that the United States is in trouble. And so they're selling things that are tied to its economy. I talked to Winnie Caesar, who's the global head of strategy at CreditSights, and this is how she put it.
The whole change in narrative around U.S. economic exceptionalism and just a general perception that the U.S. is perhaps a riskier place to park your cash than it was 6 months ago.
And this all does come back to these tariffs. They've made consumers, businesses, investors, and now other governments warn that actually maybe the United States is too risky to invest in anymore.
Maria, let me take this from the markets level to just the personal level. How is all of this going to play in our day-to-day lives?
Well, the bond market is the basis for everything that we borrow. So credit cards, car loans, mortgages. And bond yields are basically the interest rates that the government pays on its debt. So when those yields go up, it makes everything else more expensive. And meanwhile, bonds are also supposed to be the stable part of your retirement savings or your other investment accounts. But with all the stock market chaos we've seen and the ongoing warnings about tariffs increasing prices, now bonds are also in flux and loan prices are likely to go up. And so ultimately, in other words, there's just no safe haven.
NPR's Maria Aspen, great to see you.
Great to see you.
The Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has attempted to embed itself in another agency. This time, it's the Government Accountability Office. The office has refused, but as NPR's Chris Arnold reports, many experts say rather than try to elbow its way in the door, DOGE should have been asking GAO for help all along.
For months, DOGE has been strong-arming its way into government agencies, gaining access to sensitive data, and helping to fire workers. Doing that at the Government Accountability Office, that would be way over the line, says David Walker. He used to run the GAO.
The DOGE team needs to read the Constitution again. There are three separate and equal branches of government.
GAO operates under the legislative branch, in other words, Congress, not the White House.
DOGE has zero authority to review GAO's operations.
Walker's been nominated to positions by both Republican and Democratic presidents, and he says GAO and DOGE supposedly have a very similar mission, to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. Except, he says, that GAO's been doing that for decades, has a staff of several thousand people, and it's really good at it.
GAO is like a long-standing professional football team, and DOGE has some very bright people, but it's more like a much smaller pickup football team from MIT. It's like intramurals, okay?
Over the past 15 years, GAO says its recommendations have resulted in $725 billion in savings and revenue increases. It just came up with an updated list of proposals. It says that could save another $100 billion or more. Just one example, it's been studying a space-based laser communication system that the Defense Department's designing. GAO says it's found a tweak to the program that could save hundreds of millions of dollars. The White House didn't respond to NPR's request for comment, but has defended DOGE for finding waste, fraud, and abuse. And the current head of the GAO recently said that DOGE lately has been engaging more with GAO about some of its recommendations. Still, David Walker says poor planning and inadequate coordination with Congress have hamstrung DOGE.
DOGE way overpromised on savings, originally promising $2 trillion. They now claim that they've saved about $170 billion, but in reality, I think the real savings is maybe one-tenth to one-fifth of what they claim, because only Congress can cut spending.
Walker says so far, DOGE has mostly been targeting programs that the Trump administration just doesn't like and indiscriminately firing people. Linda Bilmes is a government efficiency expert at the Harvard Kennedy School. She says that DOGE could have learned a lot from GAO.
One of the real tragedies of the whole DOGE effort is that they just ignored this kind of expertise and they didn't tap into the knowledge base of the people already working in government.
She says the chance to work alongside Elon Musk to help reform government lured in a lot of very talented young people. Some of them were students of hers at Harvard.
I know firsthand some of the individuals who worked for Elon Musk, but they were not leveraged in terms of their own talents. They were put in charge of a website that they had no idea what it was and asked to fire people, and they really were put into positions in which they were entirely unsuited for.
Meanwhile, as far as DOGE trying to embed itself in GAO, there's another thorny issue there. GAO currently has dozens of investigations underway into whether the Trump administration improperly froze funding that was already allocated by Congress. David Walker again.
There clearly is a conflict of interest there. DOGE shouldn't be anywhere close to looking at what GAO is doing in connection with those activities.
The current head of GAO recently told Congress that the Trump administration was not immediately responsive to its investigations. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In the U.S., the bulk of cut flowers you find in shops are imported, so tariffs imposed by the Trump administration could cause local florists to look for homegrown alternatives. But meeting that demand could be challenging, as St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson reports.
Walking up the gravel road through the iron gates of Queen Bee Bloom's flower farm, you're instantly hit with the intoxicating smell of fresh flowers.
I can smell it already.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm gonna make you put on glasses.
the way I see things. We're going to stop right here. How's that sound?
That's the queen bee herself, Elizabeth Victor, who goes by her nickname, Luli. Her 164-acre Spanish Lake floral paradise in St. Louis County is filled with all sorts of goodies, like viburnum, lilac, and cherry blossoms. Victor does not rely on imported bulbs or other products to keep her farm up and running. She planned to expand, but her hopes for a grant from the USDA evaporated in February.
I mean, I had a couple hours of just elation. And then the next morning, the news was that all the funding was being clawed back.
Flower farmers like Victor, who do not rely on imports, could stand to benefit from the Trump administration's across-the-board universal tariffs as imported cut flowers become increasingly expensive. Roughly 80% of cut flowers sold in the U.S., including heavy hitters like roses and tulips, are imported from places like Ecuador, the Netherlands, and Colombia. Farmers say the best thing people can do is take advantage of the flowers that are native to and seasonally available in the U.S. and not subject to tariffs. But Victor says meeting the demand from local florists will be a challenge.
You can't have it both ways. You can't try to drive business back to this country while not helping us be ready for it.
Mima Davis is co-owner of Urban Buds. It's an urban flower farm in St. Louis. Davis has been in the flower farming game for 30 years.
It's kind of a wait and see kind of moment, which is maddening for the flower farmer because everything we do is a year in advance.
Right now, she and her crew are trying to navigate a new level of uncertainty. Her farm relies on imported bulbs and tubers. And thinking about what the tariffs will mean long term weighs on her.
It would mean cutting back, becoming smaller. I'm already a small farm. How small can I be?
The tariffs and USDA cuts affecting small farms and florists are heightening a decades-long problem dating back to the 90s. The U.S. promoted flower growing across South America as an economic incentive during the war on drugs. Tariffs were eliminated from cut flowers, and flower farming in Ecuador and Colombia exploded. Mom-and-pop glass greenhouses in the U.S. couldn't compete and closed their doors. In fact, the greenhouse that Urban Buds co-owner Davis later bought was one of them. Southern Illinois florist Amari Bourgeois is the owner of New Moon Bloom Co., a small black-owned business. She says the latest round of tariffs are a hard pill to swallow.
We do already have contracts and things planned out for our future, so I think initially it was a little bit of worry, like, what am I going to do in this situation? How is that going to affect us?
But because she gets some of her stash from local grower Urban Buds, she's one step ahead. As the Trump administration's back and forth on tariffs continues, people who work in the floral industry remain hopeful that there's a solution on the horizon that will benefit small farms, florists, and consumers. For NPR News, I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson in St. Louis.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Bangladesh consistently ranks among the countries with the worst air quality in the world. And yes, there are a lot of cars in its capital city, Dhaka, but the thing that makes the air smoky and black and unhealthy actually has a lot to do with the brick-making industry, which burns large amounts of coal. A new study shows a few simple tweaks to how those bricks are made could have a huge impact on the air quality in Bangladesh and other countries in South Asia. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
If you fly over Bangladesh's capital, the first thing you might notice is the haze. Look closer and you'll see dozens of smokestacks pumping out thick, dark plumes of smoke. Those are brick kilns, which produce nearly 30 billion bricks each year across the country. All that smoke comes from all the coal they have to burn to harden those bricks. Samir Mittal is an energy systems engineer and consultant in India.
It is essentially a lot of black smoke impacting the workers and the nearby villagers, and also impacting overall air quality of the region.
Some studies suggest that smoke is responsible for up to 50% of the pollution that hangs like a dense fog over Dhaka in winter. The kilns produce so much pollution because they're pretty inefficient and burn way more coal than they need to. But Mittal and his colleagues have figured out some ways around this. They realized a big problem was how clay bricks, more than 800,000 of them, are packed inside the kilns for each firing. Here's Nina Brooks, a global health researcher at Boston University.
The columns are really, really dense, so you can see almost no space in between the columns.
And then workers start shoveling coal in to get the kiln hot. But the tight spacing chokes off the oxygen needed to fire the bricks. It also blocks coal from reaching bricks at the bottom.
Because of how they're stacked and because of the process, a lot of that coal won't even get to the bottom, and so they use quite a bit more than is necessary, which is why they're so heavily polluting.
But kilns don't have to be configured this way. Mittal, the engineer, has spent years working with kiln owners in India to make them more efficient. He's found lots of ways to make a difference, but the biggest one is simply leaving more space between bricks.
The better you are able to provide air and there is better fuel and air mixing, then the possibility of black smoke will be less.
To find out just how much less black smoke could be produced, Mittal, Brooks, and their colleagues did a massive experiment. They trained some kiln owners and their workers on several simple changes, including how to stack the bricks to allow more air to flow. Another group of kilns got no training. All told, they studied 276 kilns.
So that was a big logistic challenge to train thousands of people, both classroom and practical.
But the training paid off. Fuel use dropped by about 23% for kilns that tweaked their process. The researchers estimate that drop in fuel translates to about 20% less carbon dioxide and air pollution, too. That benefits workers and people living near the kilns. The study appears in the journal Science.
The results were a little bit beyond my expectations.
Overall, the results also impressed William Checkley, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University who wasn't involved in the study.
This is wonderful evidence of how simple, low-cost interventions can have a big impact.
Realizing that impact could be challenging and would require training thousands and thousands more kiln owners and workers across Bangladesh. But the research team is already working with government officials, and if successful, these small tweaks could go a long way towards cleaning up the country's air. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Jonathan Groff has won all kinds of attention for his Broadway roles, from King George and Hamilton to his Tony-winning turn in Merrily We Roll Along. In his new musical, Just in Time, he portrays pop star Bobby Darin.
There's something really sacred and special and in the moment about what happens in live theater that feels in line with what Bobby's magic was and why it makes sense to me that we've forgotten about him a little bit, because his magic was in that live performance.
Groff has been nominated for another Tony for his role. On Wildcard, he talked with Rachel Martin about his early career and the influence of Broadway star Gavin Creel, who died of cancer last year.
What weight did you have to shoulder before you were ready?
The obvious one that's coming to my head is, like, when I came out of the closet. Through sort of like moving to New York and experiencing other people that were who they were and watching them thrive, and then falling in love with Gavin Creel, who just passed last year, and going, oh, wow, this is way better than anything. And so that was like the final like kick in the ass that I needed to like boom, fully express it and talk about it and release that weight. And the acceptance of that is now, it helps me with every other version of that in my life.
I assumed that someone who had so much success so young, that the answer would have dovetailed into something about, you know, the weight of fame. But I hear you saying that maybe you were able to manage those things because there was this fundamental weight that you had to experience, the releasing of that, and maybe that helped with all the other burdens in your young professional life.
It's interesting. There's something related to it, though, like what you're talking about with fame, because part of why I wasn't coming out was at that time in 2006, coming out was like limiting your career as an actor. And what happened when I was with Gavin and I came out was I decided to not care anymore about that. What I was feeling with him and how he was living his life was so inspirational and such a like beacon of what could be possible, that the idea of being famous or being in movies or being on television, suddenly that those ambitions became so much smaller when I felt love.
Wow. I'm so sorry about Gavin, by the way.
Huge, huge loss, but it's such a privilege to be able to talk about him, and he was one of a kind.
And what a gift he gave you in that.
Oh my God, beyond.
In that relationship, yeah.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Then you can see Jonathan Groff in Just in Time on Broadway now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, with a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D.
Are heaven on earth to me. They may be full of the devil. When you see them smile, angels with dirty faces, make your life worthwhile. The love and the laughter of little kitties makes up for lots of things.